Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening, everyone. I am Lauren Tenney, and welcome to the Talk with Tenney show. We have another great night lined up tonight, looking at misogyny, discrimination, and psychiatry. And we have a guest online right from the start. Jean, would you introduce yourself and tell a little bit about what you'd like to talk about?
Sure. My name is Jean Peschier, and I have started the site, the Mental Health Civil Rights Movement protest, but I wanted to talk about my experience with electroshock treatment. And this happened in 2003 and 2007. I had a series in 2003, and then in 2007, when I was very depressed, they told me, I ended up in the emergency room, and they told me that I had the two options. Either I stayed in the private hospital and had ECT voluntarily, or they would have me involuntarily committed to the state psychiatric hospital, in which case they would have done them anyways and worse, probably.
So those were your choices. You could either stay here in the nice, pretty place, or get shipped off to the state hospital and have the same thing or worse happen to you.
Exactly.
Great.
No option number three or four or nothing, you know, because that's really that. Unfortunately, for a lot of people, that's all the options they get. And it really, so I didn't have a choice, really, did I?
Was there an informed consent process or
nothing,
anything like that?
No. No. I heard Marie's story last night, and my story is similar to hers, but they show you a video, you know, a very benign video of the process.
Yes, Kathy was talking about the video last night also. And I'm sorry to interrupt, and so a benign...
Yeah, the really benign movie showing how benign the treatment is. And I had, so altogether I had over 20. And I've heard this from other people who have had shock treatments. They took away my personality. I became a different person. I talked to someone once who had shock treatments around the same time I did. She said, I woke up a year later, and she lost a year out of her life.
A year.
And she woke up, it was like all of a sudden she came out of the trance, and she had gained like 100 pounds and chain smoked. And this is, it numbs your brain.
For listeners who may not know what electroshock is, and who may just be tuning in and who just don't know about any of this, or even that it's still done any longer, to understand that they're passing 100 to 190 volts of electricity through the brain in order to create a grand mal seizure, epilepsy, which, you know, millions of dollars every year is invested in fighting against, and it requires general anesthesia now in more modern times, which carries an inherent risk of death. So just for listeners who may not have an idea in their head of what we're talking about here, this is 20, more than 20 times, Jeannie, you have this happen to you.
More than 20, and it has taken me, I worked full time for years up until that point. Afterwards, I have not even been able to hold down a part-time job for more than 6 months. I'm on disability. I live in poverty. I do not have a vehicle. And it's taken me 7 years to read, you know, to finally get to the point where I feel like I'm starting to get back my old self.
What a crime. I'm not even sure what to ask other than what else would you like to say?
Well, I wanted to add, I heard a gentleman talk the other night as well about his experience, and I could relate to the extreme anxiety and almost terror I felt afterwards. I was talk about, I mean, all the symptoms that they're trying to treat, I had afterwards. And also, of course, they put me on multiple medications, which I'm now tapering off of. But I was terrified. I had so much anxiety. And eventually I became so full of rage because of it's extremely traumatic. And the only way I was able to, going under anesthesia terrified me, especially three times a week. So they finally agreed to allow me to do the rest of them outpatient. And I got out of the hospital, and I never went back. And luckily, they didn't come after me.
People tend to say that works. Just stop going there. But they weren't able to involuntarily detain you, and they can do that to many people, right?
Because I wasn't depressed anymore. I was just I don't even remember. I don't remember at this point. There's so much I don't remember from my life. It's funny because I mean I don't mean to. I hang out with my parents a lot, and we get along great because they have severe memory issues because they're almost 80 years old, and I have severe memory issues from ECT. So we just sit around and say, "Oh, I can't remember. I can't remember. Can you?" There's so much that it takes from your memory that you never get back.
God, what a crime! What a crime against humanity!
And it really. It really needs to be to be stopped because it is not therapy. It is torture.
This is such a human rights violation.
Yeah, the symptoms. If you look at the symptoms, they're very similar to a very severe brain injury, or the symptoms someone has after repeated major seizures. You know, they're very severe symptoms of brain injury.
Right, and for people who may just be tuning in or aren't clear as to what we're talking about what is called what is electric shock to the brain, and what is commonly called quote unquote electric convulsive treatment. And that this is, as Don was saying the other night, this is not a treatment issue. This is a human rights violation. This is torture. This is a crime against humanity, and people must stop it passing 100 to 190 volts of electricity through the brain. Of course, how could it not? The goal is to create brain damage, and it's destroying lives. And Jeannie, I thank you so much for speaking out, and I heard you on the Diane Rehm show, and
yeah.
I want to thank you for being able to get through and being on air. But I also want to say that I was deeply embarrassed for for Diane Rehm when she cut you off, and really feel that she did a disservice to messaging to making it clear that there was one side that wanted to be heard, and that was the only side that would be given any voice. So.
Did you hear what Dr. Torrey said? Responded to what I had to say. He said, "If I'm sorry if psychiatric treatment isn't helpful to everyone." That was what he said.
That's right.
So, anyways, I just wanted to get on and share, but I'll let you go ahead with your show.
Yeah, and I just want to really thank you. And there's an event coming up, right? That you're.
Well, we're working on a protest for October 2nd in Washington D.C. But I have a background in community organizing and social activism, in mental health and in politics, and I really believe that in order to change things, we have to go back to our roots and do social activism and hit the streets and have protests. And we need to have massive protests, and things aren't going to change unless enough people are willing to do that. So, you know, if people could go to Mental Health Civil Rights Protest on Facebook, it's a group, and join and, you know, offer to volunteer. You know, Lauren, we can't do it on our own. We have to do
right.
it together. So
right.
thank you very much.
Absolutely. And if you'd like to stay on the line and if people would like to call in, the number is area code 267-521-0167. Area code 267-521-0167. And part of what I wanted to talk tonight about on the show was this Daily News article that Virginia called in yesterday and spoke out about, of where they're talking about that Jackie O, after a domestic dispute with JFK, I believe while he was still a senator, because she was sick of his affairs, wound up being institutionalized and electroshocked 3 times. I was able to find corroborating evidence of this actually back to Kitty Kelly's book, Jackie O, in 1978, where she discussed both Jackie having been subjected to electroshock and Rosemary Kennedy's botched lobotomy that destroyed her. So I think that this idea that anybody is safe from this happening to them, or that this is just happening to some select group of people, is really a myth that needs to be destroyed. And the idea that Jackie could, and because of a domestic dispute. And so when you look back to different writings over history and how women have been treated and have been institutionalized at the hands of their brothers, fathers, uncles, and how men have been able to really with malice have women locked up and treated in these ways and electroshocked and everything else, and that this is not a 20th century, 21st century problem. There's evidence of this dating all the way back to at least the 19th century. And Geller and Harris's Women of the Asylum is a book that I suggest everybody should read, with the firsthand accounts of many women pioneers in the lunatics liberation movement of the 19th century. And this included Elizabeth Stone and Phoebe Davis and Elizabeth Packard. And so in the foreword of Women of the Asylum's Phyllis Chesler, who I think also people should familiarize themselves with, who wrote the groundbreaking book Women and Madness in 1972. She wrote in the foreword in the Geller and Harris book, quote, "In the midst of this work, I attended the 1970 APA convention. Instead of delivering an academic paper on behalf of AWP, I asked the assembled APA members for $1 million in reparations for those women who had never been helped by mental health professions, but who had, in fact, been further abused, punitively labeled, ordered to adjust to their lives as second- and third-class citizens, and blamed when in treatment, hospitalized, often against their will, given shock and insulin coma therapy or lobotomies, straitjacketed, both physically and chemically, and used as slave labor in state mental asylums." Quote, she then writes, quote, "Maybe AWP could set up an alternative to a mental hospital with the money I suggested, or a shelter for runaway wives." 2,000 of my colleagues were in the audience. They seemed shocked. Many laughed loudly, nervously. Some looked embarrassed, others relieved. Quite obviously, I was, quote, crazy. Afterward, someone told me that jokes had been made about my, quote, penis envy. Friends, this was the 1970, not 1870, and I was a colleague on the platform at the podium. And so Phyllis Chesler's work and others who have really spoken out against women being abused and held in slavery and shocked and have been speaking out for a really long time, and we need to continue to call attention to these issues of how women are treated by psychiatry. If you'd like to call in, the number is 267-521-0167. And on this very special and rare occasion, we actually, for people in the lower 48 states, there is a toll-free line, area code 855-346-3351. That's area code 855-346-3351. And so I just think it's important to bring attention to these issues and how it's discussed and not really looked at. I also want to bring people's attention to Kate Millett's work and the Looney Bin trip, which I think that people really would benefit from reading also. On katemillett.com/katemillett/looney.html, you can find this little synopsis. And I am telling you what happened to me, Kate Millett says, in the hope that it may help all those who have been or are about to be in the same boat. Her story illuminates not only the personal, but also the social conditions of mental illness. A new preface and comments on recent movements for patients' rights and Notes Touchstones books that have been begun to treat the still taboo ground of psychiatric confinement. And so I think that there are definitely places where we can be speaking out and how that happens.
I agree with you, Lauren. This is Jeannie. And I think that a lot of times people feel such shame connected to electric shock because they might feel somehow that, they brought it on themselves or because it's so stigmatized by society that it's hard for people to talk about. But it's something that needs to be talked about if it's going to change.
I think that that's absolutely true, and I think the events like the one that you've got set up, is there a way that people can find that information for where the event is and how they can maybe get involved with it?
Oh, yeah, they can go to the group on Facebook, and it's the Civil Rights Movement Protest, Mental Health Civil Rights Protest Facebook group. They can find more information on the protest and a whole host of things. I've been posting information I get from the Network Against Psychiatric Assault and information from you and a lot of other groups on there as well.
Yes, and I'm looking at it. This is an open group, and if you put in the search term mental health civil rights protest, it will bring you right to it. And this has just started up recently, right?
It's just a week old, yeah?
Just a week old, right in on the ground level. That's fabulous. And so and the event would be, is it scheduled currently, or it will be getting...
Jim Godstein, who folks know from the Psych Rights, I had it initially for October 4th, and he wanted to change it till October 2nd, during the which is a Thursday. So it really is up to people if it happens, because there is no reason it can't happen, but it depends on if there is enough will from enough people. Obviously, we need to have enough people and enough people volunteering to make it happen, because it is a big undertaking. But it is. So I'd say tentatively planned for October 2nd, but there's no reason it can't happen.
Great. Well, that's great, and I think that there's, you know, the fraud of psychiatry and the idea of using their language really gets to me. And so, you know, calling this what it is psychiatric labels and a fraudulent medical diagnoses, the medical fraud that is committed by psychiatry is really deeply, deeply problematic. And how they're infringing on the rights of people in society. And once any one of our rights are taken away, we can all just say forget it, because the rights of the loss of one are the rights of the loss of all of us, and since there's no actual biological test or brain scan or any way to prove that any of these supposed assignments are legitimate medical diagnoses, they should not be allowed to force and court order and coerce and give these things to people without full informed consent and choice. And Jeannie, I think the description of the choice that you gave earlier is just really mind-blowing to me, of either you can have it here at this nice place, or you can get involuntarily committed to the state to have it there. And that's just such not a choice, and so many people aren't really getting that. Area code 863, your line is open.
Hi, nice to meet you all. This is Manya Anderson.
Hi, Manya. How are you?
I'm doing pretty good. Took a long nap earlier. Almost missed the show. But anyways, I'm glad to make it on. I caught briefly what you've been talking about. I'd like to hear a little bit more, and so I can follow more of the discussion that's going on.
Okay, great.
Thank
well,
you.
If you have any comments or questions, feel free to feel free to jump in.
I will.
Great.
Definitely.
I also have another caller on the line. That's just your line is open.
Yeah, I'm here.
Hi, who's this?
This is Greg calling from Nashville, Tennessee.
Hi, Greg. How are you?
I'm good. Fascinating topic. The first thing that came to my mind when I was listening to you guys talk is the prevalence of misogyny in institutions like the Catholic Church, the Christian Church, and really just in America in general. It's prevalent all over, and I think there's a veil that covers it in the media. Although women are constantly portrayed as victims in the media, it continues to sell books, it continues to sell movies, and I think it's a shame, because the further you go back in history, the more female oppression you see everywhere. And then when you talked about psychiatry, the first thing that came to my mind was an essay that I read back in the late 90s, and it was called Doctor as God is Dead or Dying. And I think, unfortunately, that's not happening fast enough in this country, because people still hold these people in these white coats up as demigods, and they just take what they say for the truth. And that opens door for the abuse that you're talking about. So I totally, totally feel what it is that you're saying.
Well, thank you. And I think White Coats, Mass Murderers, I think, is the name of the book that Lenny Lampoon wrote, and people should check that out. And it's true. Our media does it. It's not limited to just the United States. All over the world, women are treated awfully objectified, and that there's this stereotype that is developed out of it as to what men it should be receiving. And I think, you know, one of the things that I really think we need to tie into here is that Elliot Rodger, who has quickly been removed from the news, probably due to Hollywood influence, is, you know, that what was going on there was misogyny. It was a hatred toward women because they wouldn't behave with him the way Hollywood says women are supposed to behave. And that not being ever corrected, I think it remains an issue. Area code 613, your line is open.
Hi, Lauren, it's Sue. How are you doing?
I'm good, Sue. How are you?
Yes, I just want to say one thing, that electroshock or ECT should be called electrical brain torture. I'm not going to use ECT because it's torturing the brain. That I had a friend's brother, he went to a coma, and I went down to the Elizabeth, it's called the Briere Center in Ottawa. It's on near Sussex. I went into his room. He was huddled up. And my friend, a lawyer, and he shouldn't have done this. I thought it was rude. He put his hand right over his head, his eyes. I said, Harry, don't be doing that. And the guy didn't blink. And then his sister put him in a wheelchair, all dressed up with glasses, and his eyes just rolled around in his head. So I saw someone in a coma from electroshock.
Oh.
It's frightening because I thought it was, because when I went down the hall and saw him in the wheelchair, I thought that could have been me in a coma. He died 7 years later.
Torture. And meanwhile, you had a heart attack while you were shocked, right?
Yes, I did, because I had my fifth shock treatment, and I died on the table, and I came back. But I don't want to talk too long, because I like to listen on the show. I like to listen. But,
absolutely,
but
I
have hearing problems as well. I have hearing problems as well. So just wanted to tell you about that man. I still remember him, and I can't even hardly talk about it. It just makes me so tearful, you know. And this man, he went to the Royal Ottawa Hospital, and he told him he had heart disease. And anyhow, what happened, he had a wife and a son who was 17 years old. And, you know, they did this to him. He fell in his room, had a heart attack, and went to a coma, and they transferred him to the long-term care called the Elizabeth Briere Center on Briere Avenue. And my friend Harry said, let's go and see him. But I didn't think it was good of Harry to put his hand right over his face. I said, Harry, I said, that wasn't nice. But you know what I'm saying? And my friend was a lawyer, so.
Jeez.
You know, like.
Torture. It's torture, and it's a crime against humanity.
And you're doing a great job on this show because people have to know what's going on. My main focus, of course, is always electroshock. But you know what? I'm badly damaged. I mean, I went to Carleton U in 1995, and I had to leave after 3 months because I couldn't remember what I was learning. It wasn't that I didn't have the aptitude. You can't learn. I mean, if you can't remember, you can't learn. Okay, Lauren, you're doing a good show.
I'm thanks,
going
Sue.
Now because I have hearing problems. It's better if I listen, okay?
Sue, and before you go, I want to thank you for putting up that Facebook post. And next Wednesday night, June 11th, we are going to be having another special on electroshock.
Yes.
Focusing on informed consent and litigation strategies. Mm-hmm. And Deborah from ectjustice.com is going to be joining us, and we're going to talk
mm-hmm.
all night about different ways that potentially legal action can be taken for psychiatric malpractice. And she's going to talk about the way she was able to settle out of court on a psychiatric malpractice suit. And so this is something that people need to be aware of and realize that there are people out there who, no matter, Deborah is a shock survivor also, and no matter what has happened to one in one's life, that you, that there are support networks and there are people who can help and assist you and point you to ways where you can better educate yourself about how to get out. And that there is real possibility and hope here, and that we're not just talking with no idea of what we have to offer. We have plenty to offer. And so, mm-hmm. Sue, I want to thank you for that.
No problem. Thank you. And I just want to say one thing before I go, that the electrical brain torture kills people 1 in 200, and that 70% it's called percent, is given to the older women over 60. It maims the brain. It tortures the brain. I have the permanent memory loss, and I have a learning problem now. I never had that before shock. I had a heart attack, and then people after electroshock have the problems with seizures, because I know someone down in Michigan, he's 20. He had 40, and now he has seizure problems. He has to take medication to stop the seizures. So this is a terrible thing. It's torture and has to be stopped. Thanks very much. We'll talk to you tomorrow night. Bye.
Thanks, absolutely. And I think, Jeannie, I don't know if you're still on the line, Jeannie.
I'm still here, yep.
Thank you.
Thanks. You know, this idea of brain damage, and you had mentioned that earlier, that there were a lot of the experiences you had can be seen under the terms of brain damage. And so I'm just wondering, would you inform people a little bit more about your ideas?
So here's an example. I have a college degree. I've always had, for the most part, I worked full-time, and I had a variety of jobs, you know, working for a newspaper, working, I was an advocate. I was actually a mental health worker at one time. I did, you know, I had good jobs. And after the ECTs, I was fired from the gas station, you know, as a cashier after 2 weeks because I could not remember anything. So it took away my ability to make a living. And you know what the psychiatrist told me? He told me, you need to go home, stay home, and get on disability. Isn't that nice?
It's such a crime. Oh. It really is. It's such a crime.
The only way I could remember things afterwards is I would have to write every single thing down. If I didn't write it down, and still I have that problem sometimes, but if I didn't write everything down, I would forget. So it's really, yeah.
On that notation, don't mind me interrupting. This is Monty Anderson. Back in, I had written on one of Mary Maddox's sites, about what had happened to my mother back in the 40s. I didn't elaborate much on it. I had gotten a response just earlier, an email, and somebody asking me to email my story to someone in reference to editing the story. And it has to do with my mother. She was 17, and she left home at the age of 16. And she was an entertainer, a self-made entertainer. She was, it's a very high, high non-solicited story that was covered up in the media because she entertained with the Rat Pack and a lot of the community out there as far as the entertainment world is concerned. And dancing back then, it was like women today dancing, you know, it's burlesque type dancing, but now they would consider it, you know, where you're kind of taking off your clothes. My mother was in an era where, last of her era, which was not taking off all her clothes, but it was more or less of an art. And what had happened was that back then when you danced amongst in clubs, and a lot of them, these clubs like Prohibition, you know, during that and after that, most of them were owned by the mafia. And when, you know, she didn't realize what she was getting into, and she was to be married, and they thought she knew too much, and she, for many, many years, I was told that she was in a car accident. And what ended up happening to her was they took her. She was in her hotel room, staying at the hotel. I can't say where. I can't elaborate too much on it. And they took everybody out in the hotel, and they went up to my mother's room and tried to silence her. And they poured acid on her head and her back and her face.
Oh, my God.
And they left her there for dead. And, yeah, it was covered, deeply, deeply bedded and covered. And what ended up happening was that they put her in a psych. My grandmother came to get her, got word of it. She was taken to the hospital. She was then silently taken from the hospital from the family because they were afraid of her life being taken. And a matter of fact, the records were removed from the hospital. They tried to save her because by the time they got to her, gangrene had already set in. And what they wanted to do was they ended up wanting to silence her. After 6 months of treatment, they gave her electroshock therapy, telling her that this would help her forget these memories that she had gone through. So they put her through a series of electroshock. And to this day, she still has, she was maimed badly. She ended up having to have a metal plate put into her head. And she's maimed on her back and on her forehead. And it's a terrible, terrible story because it's happening all the time, especially politically. People are being taken and being silenced because they don't want people to know what's going on in the world. And my mother is now in her 80s, and she still suffers from brain issues. And in her mind, she still thinks that what she did was the best thing for her because of the memories. But that's what they wanted her to believe. And when you're in your 80s, I mean, how do you change your mind thinking? Fortunately, she was able to get away from it all. She fled. She never went back to it. But for a child, you know, at the age of 17 to be tortured and then took to a hospital, state hospital, and then wanting everything covered. Yeah, and to be tortured again, to want to remove the memories because she lived in the limelight. That's like what they're doing to our children now. I mean, DCF is taking our children away from us, putting them into foster care, drugging them because they get more financial, the pharmaceutical companies get paid more, plus the government, and they get funding through these programs for our children to be taken and put in foster care and labeled ADHD or put on meds because have anxiety issues, or I mean, that's torture itself, being taken from their families for no substantial reasoning.
Absolutely, and we look at what's happening to Justina Pelletier, for example, and her family, who is getting her medical treatment. The psychiatrist disputed the diagnosis, said that it was some somatoform disorder that they have zero evidence for existing. Took her parents' rights away from her, put a gag order on her family that they couldn't speak out, and you know, some 16, 17 months later, she's now gone from a competitive ice skater to having to use a wheelchair because she's being denied medical treatment. And the experimentation on children in foster care system, Lonnie, thank you for bringing this up again, because we continually are talking about the issues of children being involved with psychiatry like this, and particularly children in foster care. There's already a clear trauma. They've, for whatever reason, lost their family. That is what should be being dealt with. They don't need to be being drugged. They need to be healing. And it's just horrifying.
Lauren, can I mention something that Yvonne Smith just posted online? This is Jeannie.
Yes.
This is from the Washington Post. With every new traumatic shooting that rivets the nation, mental health becomes a hot topic for debate for a short while before dying down until the next disaster. In an attempt to move the dialogue into action, the National Alliance on Mental Illness, NAMI, and the Cigna Foundation are hosting an all-day forum titled "It's Time to Take Action: Innovative Community Approaches to Children's Mental Health."
It's they're actually on my list tonight, as is the Behavioral Coalition of people who have now just put out this Stamp Out Stigma campaign, where they're just perpetrating lies that this is based on a biological disorder, and that the National Alliance on Mental Illness is actually named as an organization where people should go get information from, and it's an absolute fraud. And people need to know that they're after our children. They are absolutely with intention coming after young people. And
definitely.
And the bills, the legislation that is out there right now is going after, with the intent of going after, young people and young adults and veterans. And the way that they're mushing together post-traumatic stress and some biological, quote-unquote, brain disease that has no evidence of existing is horrifying to me. And we know that 2 out of 3 girls and 1 out of every 3 boys are abused in this country before their 16th birthday. We know that. We know that 96% of people who are in psychiatric histories have childhood histories of abuse and neglect. We know that. This is not the current march that everybody is on here. We're in such trouble. And so, Jeannie, I don't know if you're still on the line, but I appreciate the work that you're doing to try to organize protests again and get people to the streets. For anybody who's in New York or near New York, the Mental Patients Liberation Alliance, the Alliance's 34th annual Bastille Day vigil, will be held in front on the sidewalk in front of the New York State Office of Mental Health in Albany, July 13th to the 16th. And we hold vigils for 16 hours because that's how long that they can detain, assess, and treat anyone in determining whether or not to have us institutionalized. And so there are a lot.
I'm going to post information on that, so because that's the first that folks can attend.
Yes, absolutely. I'll make sure it gets on the page, on your page, and we'll get it out there. And I think people really need to speak out and take action. Yvonne, I don't know, are you on the line, Yvonne?
Yes, I am.
Would you talk a little bit about taking action and what some of your ideas for that?
Well, in reference to this Washington Post article, you know, I'm very keen about this because I think that people lay the groundwork before they do any legislative action. And my focus is to try to not browbeat, but to talk to the reporters who write the story. Anybody can go to WashingtonPost.com, and the title of the story is 3 Innovative Ways to Address. We're 3 Innovative Ways to Address Mental Health Issues. And I have found this out because I do have on my Facebook page some reporters that are my friends, is that when they have the comment that people should make comments about it, there's already been some comments about it already, but also to email the reporter. In this case, there is a reporter. Sometimes there isn't. Valerie Sprouse, and to give them information that so that they don't start, they keep linking violence with mental health issues. This particular article is about a meeting or conference that they had at George Washington University, and they talked about this as being innovative. But what they're talking about is actually going into the schools and screening children for mental health issues. And Lauren and Sue, if you're on the line, you know that if they screen for mental health issues, they're going to find a mental health issue, right?
That's right.
So they're going to sort and categorize and label. And I am very afraid of databases being there because I think that we create stigma, meaning we create stigma. So my action steps, I would say, is to go to the Washington Post article, sign in and make comments, and also click on the writer. The writer of this is an education writer. We don't have people sometimes that cover mental health. L.A. Times does a good job of covering mental health. Sometimes the New York Times does, but L.A. Times has a separate issue. So when these articles come out, what happens is I think the reporters just don't, they really don't know. And we should give them information of how this can be abusive because they get information, as I said to Maxine earlier today when I talked to her, they see people with initials behind their name, large organizations, and in the comments somebody says, well, National Alliance of Mental Illness has been very well known to be working with people about mental illness. My objection is that they keep linking violence, and there is going to be another shooting. And we do need to pay attention to children who have trauma in their lives, that come to school, who might be abused or have other issues. You do need to pay attention to that. But I think the idea of screening and sorting all of their children because you want to try to prevent some violence that may or may not occur is dangerous to people because something that you said when you were 8 years old could keep you from getting the security clearance. And I just urge people to go to the WashingtonPost.com site, go to the article, Three Innovative Ways to Address Mental Health Issues, and to make a comment on the blog page. Oftentimes, I found, and I was told this, the people who assign people articles, when there's a lot of comments, they do a backup story. So want to have them to give the other side, and you also, those that care to have a lot of information, is to email Valerie Strauss, who happens to be the reporter on this story, to email her so that she can understand that this really doesn't address health issues and that she should not be linking the California incident. And this is what I object to. Every incident that comes out, they use that to promote something that is an overkill.
Right. I'm just looking at the article here, and it looks like there's an article immediately underneath Valerie Strauss's article that is by Mary Gilberti and Stuart Lustig that really goes right into the issues. It starts off with the gun debate again. And
yeah.
this constant, any level 100 psychology student would be expected to know how you condition fear into a person. And it is by associating a loud, scary thing with something that isn't ordinarily considered to be scary. And the media is successfully conditioning society to be scared of people with a psychiatric history by this continued association of violence and psychiatry. It's really important for people to know that violence isn't actually any symptom in anything with schizophrenia or any of the other supposed psychiatric labels that people have. I often tell people that when you look at the actual diagnostic criteria for mania, you want to talk about misogyny, right, and all of the women who are diagnosed bipolar on a regular basis. And the bipolar criteria includes things like being excessively happy, succeeding at work, engaging in a lot of pleasurable activities, like sex. And so these are all kinds of things that wind up, if you're a woman, getting diagnosed based on social values and culture and political and personal beliefs. And then they're just being shocked and then or having their memory wiped away. And Lonnie, I don't know if you're still on the line, but the what you shared about your mother, what torture?
Definitely, it's done daily to our children now. Back in the 90s, when stuff in the 80s, I remember psychiatric was just coming out about talking with your children. I remember there were books on tough love and how to raise children and about questioning whether we should be even spanking our children or talking to them in a different method. And up until that point, you really didn't hear much about mental health or talking with your children, or it was all hush-hush, you know, hospitalize our children, institutionalize them. If they got pregnant when they were children, you know, send them away. Because it was unethical for families to have children who got pregnant before they were married, so they'd send them off to some monastery somewhere, and then their children be taken from them there, or abused, or tortured, or even killed in a lot of these institutions.
So I won't lose the train of thought. At some time, Dr. Kenny, and when it's appropriate in the broadcast, I'd like to talk about a conversation that we had at a patient council at St. Elizabeth about sex in the hospital. But I want to draw people back attention to this article that's in the Washington Post, because, in one of the parts of the article says, to avoid tragedies, solutions are needed. So I think, for me, is the importance is that they promote these screenings and early interventions as a way of preventing violence. And that's what I object to. You know, it may be very good to pay attention to children that might have, you know, they may have some trauma going on at home, and they come to school. A teacher will notice that more so than somebody else. If you're a kid, whether you're 5 years old, 8 years old, or 15 years old, and if you're being abused by mom, dad, stepdad, or boyfriend, a teacher's certainly going to notice that. But I
just that's not what they're training people to look for.
But understand that what they say is to avoid tragedies. Again, this is people have to pay attention to it because it's very subtle. And what happens is they usually is a long, prolonged campaign in the news media, in the press, printing press. And in the television, and it's very subtle. And I'm not saying there's a conspiracy, but then when another tragedy occurs, and somebody wants some draconian measures done, like let's say screen all kids and have some kind of prevalence scheme for whether the person is dangerous or not. You don't want to have somebody. You don't want to have somebody seen as being dangerous. That is the biggest thing for stigma. The reason why people don't want people that have supposedly mental health histories in their neighborhood is because they're fearful for dangerous. I spent enough time in meetings where, and I don't think people should be in group homes, but some people do like them, where people want to get people out of group homes. And the argument that people give their neighbors, they say, I have children. I said, so what, you have children? And they have this thing about danger. But I just want to say that, you know, try to go to the website. I hope that other people, when they see articles like that, that they would post them on social media or other places, not saying that you agree. I post a lot of things that I don't agree with because I want a conversation, and I feel as though that we should talk to the press. At another time, somewhere in the program, I'd like to talk about, I know at St. Elizabeth's Hospital, they came to the patient government and asked the patients whether they wanted to, whether it was okay to have condoms for sex. And for a long time, what happens is people don't think, I know that we're all out here in the community and we live our lives, but many people, even if they live in the community, therapists don't think you have the right to have a sexual life. And that's a part of oppression as well, is discouraging. You said that some behaviors, like if you go and you report to your therapist that you feel, a social worker, that you feel sexy, that automatically becomes some kind of symptom to be chemically suppressed. And some of these things that are said, just like the article, they're very subtle, and they are a way of oppressing people from having a normal life, and that we should be able to take action so that our brothers and sisters who might not have as much freedom as we, that they realize that they do have the right to be sexual beings. You do have the right to be intimate. You have the right to have to hope for marriage, to have children and things like that. And part of psychiatry says that you're an ill person. As somebody said, you go home and you be happy, get on disability, you know, and you should be happy with that, just that you eat, sleep. I call it EST, eat, sleep, and take prescription medication. And we should not.
And I think that's exactly it. And I it's very disturbing to me that when you're on the Washington Times article here, three innovative ways to address mental health issues by Valerie Strauss, and it says you know, blah 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 blah. You can learn more here. And when you click the hyperlink of where it says learn more here, it takes you directly to the National Alliance on Mental Illness. And so I feel like if they are putting links to NAMI in the Washington Times, they should be putting links to mindfreedom.org or psychrights.org or banelectroshock.org or any of these other websites that are pushing out information that is this. But the idea that the Washington Times gives that much legitimacy to what the National Alliance on Mental Illness is doing, what NAMI is doing, they really should be held accountable for this.
Well, this is Washington Post, which is a national newspaper that a lot of people, just like the New York Times and the Wall Street Journal, this is a national newspaper that people have. And, in fact, a couple of people they mentioned in the article actually know. And, you know, but they are putting links to it. So this is what my contention has been all along. This is why I say I'm a poor writer. I try the best I can. I ask people to help me with it. And that's why we need a media kit, because the press really doesn't know. When they Google things, they come up high in the chain. That's why I'm so glad that yourself, Lauren, and other people, not that you're buying into psychiatry or psychology, but sometimes you have to go to school to infiltrate these places, because we have to be able to come with the authority. We have to come with the authority. So, another one of your callers on the line called and talked to me today, and gave me information, because I was talking about getting on the medical board here. And they said, well, they would help me and give me any information that I needed so that I would be able to talk authoritatively and point to these studies and things, because sometimes they just discount what we're saying. And as I said, they have a pipeline. I didn't suppress that we don't have
a pipeline. That's right. It's an absolute pipeline. And I also want to thank you for bringing up this issue of just sexuality in general. And I remember when years after I had been locked up at South Beach on Staten Island in the adolescent unit, I'd gone back to do some kind of, I don't know, where I thought that I was going to be able to make some kind of change with these people. I was walking around, and the person was explaining to me that they, even though the unit was co-ed, that their strategy was to only let boys sit next to boys and girls sit next to girls on the couches, and that was a very effective strategy. And I said to her, well, what if somebody's LGBT? Cute. At the time, LGBT. And she said, oh, we don't have that here. I said, oh, you don't have that here? What year is this? This is like had to be at least 1999 or 2000. And so the idea of how sexuality is handled by psychiatry in itself is an issue, on top of the misogyny that many women have to go through and the discrimination and gender discrimination of being considered less than or a second or third class citizen, as Phyllis Chesler said. And so these issues are real, and the idea that a male figure in a woman's life can give the testimony to a doctor that is needed as quote-unquote evidence dating back to the 19th century, that this is just horrifying, and it's wrong, and people need to speak up about it.
Well, you know something, the thing about it is I go to these meetings like twice a month as support, and I'm not a paid advocate. I've been involved in the hospital for like 20 years, so I don't, like I said, I don't give up. I had a contract maybe a long time ago, about 8 years ago, but no longer, I guess. I didn't realize that, you know, you really can't speak your mind. But I had reached this year ago, and I have to say, give kudos to Susan Rogers, who gave me information about LGBTQ and forensic with that trip to the hospital, and they were acting like it didn't occur. And when they came and they asked the question, the staff in the hospital said, we're not saying that this is okay, because one of the council members said, well, yeah, we think that we should have, they should have access to condoms. And they took a vote, and only one person didn't think it was a good idea. They said, well, I don't think these people should be having sex. But the question they said is, and the staff says, we're not saying that the hospital is saying it's okay to have sex. But the thing about it is, they were thinking of preventing you to keep down on HIV.
And these are adults, right? This isn't an adolescent unit. This is an adult unit, right? These are adults that people are talking about here.
This is a council that each ward has a council. And what
right,
happens
but the people
is,
that they're talking about are adults, people who are inmates who are adults.
Yeah, and I was about to throw up, and I had to speak, because usually I'm very supportive. And the thing about it is, that's fine if you're going to be somewhere for a few weeks. But, you know, I'm in a room with people that have been there 20, 30 years. I know people who have had children while they were there. I think I know one person that's on a film. The guy just died. He was 93 years old. He died this past year. He had fathered two children with another person. I know people. I don't know that they're not there now, but they had their children by staff. So people are having sex. We used to teasingly say this. We call it Bush therapy. So, you know, it's unrealistic to think that you have someone who's locked away. Even in prison, people have conjugal rights. Because my question wanted to be, but I didn't want to do anything to take away from the fact that they might give them sex education, they might have condoms. What happens if you have a person who is married and they got somebody who's in the hospital? I mean, don't they have the and even in prison, if you're a male person or female person and you are married, or even, I don't think even married, they have a place for you to go and have sex or whatever else. But the whole idea that we cannot be sexual beings, that if you go talk to your psychiatrist, social worker, whatever, you mention even anything about sex, that is a symptom, and that's a reason to give you something to tap down on your sexuality. I mean, I just think about that poor guy out in California that you said that his expectations were so high. A Washington Post report, I'm getting back to Washington Post again, was calling the topic of saying that, you know, that the Hollywood has made expectations so high that a person who is 22 years old and a virgin, they feel pressed.
Well, yeah, I mean, I think it's, I want to just clarify that when I said Hollywood, living in Hollywood, I mean like literally living in Hollywood. I mean being the son of the assistant director of the Hunger Games. I mean being, not just watching what Hollywood is portraying in movies, but actually being there. I think there's a big distinction between just watching a movie and literally growing up in the environment of Hollywood in these kinds of ways, and the many things that experiences he had along the way, including a traumatic divorce that he experienced, but the hatred toward women that he developed was definitely linked to the experiences in his writings that he was having with other people who were high power, wealthy kind of people.
Well, some of that's a theme, and sometimes I keep saying this, Lauren. Sometimes we just have to think that there are some things that are unavoidable. The Virginia Tech guy, he had some of the same issues. He was he had unrequited love. He was not a person that was very social, and you know, many of these things have to do with people's being social, their sociability. You know, I have to say myself, I have struggled in the past to be a very social person. And people don't want to see is that, you know, maybe in a school, instead of concentrating on mental health, maybe we should do other things. Just like, you know, I mean, we're taking off all the things about kids being bullying, how you're supposed to treat each other, females and males, to have respect for each other, stuff. These little simple things, we're pathologizing everything and not trying to have healthy human beings of how we interchange and talk and deal with each other. And I think a lot of times some of this will be more helpful to people than screening a person and they go to a child psychologist or something, and you and I know what's going to happen. What kind of help are they going to get? If they find the person has
they're
going to
get drugged. They're going to get drugged, and they're going to be at a higher risk for being involuntarily committed. And if they can get themselves out, they'll be at a higher risk for involuntary outpatient torture.
Unless they get them out under like person like you, they won't be a Dr. Penny because you know the previous panelists talked about how, and I can speak this from personal experience, the medications make you so dull that you can't perform. So I mean,
that's an intentional side effect. And nobody can convince me of otherwise. The fact that these drugs are working on insulin and that they're working on the libido, which is the two things that they have been trying to address since the early 1900s, and the insulin and metrazole shock and screwing with our metabolic system, the hormonal system, and the way that it prevents people from being able to orgasm or ejaculate, that this is part of the design.
No, you're right. I have been to conferences wherein there was people from NIMH, and this is not even recent. This is 10 years ago where they said, you know, we found the gene for schizophrenia, and it's got the same address as diabetes. So it is true. I mean, they don't hide it. It is true that the intention is maybe not to have that, but they use the same address. So the person has weight gain that leads to diabetes, that the person has a malfunction. You take someone who's 22, 23 years old, who's married or they're not married, they're in a relationship, and then all of a sudden they have sexual dysfunction. I mean, you're in essence castrating person.
It is, I've seen links to the polycystic ovarian disease with drugs like Depakote, and which would prevent or limit the chances because people can still get pregnant with polycystic ovaries. That's a myth that you can't. But it limits the possibility for pregnancy. It's just an all out assault, and psychiatry kills people, and the mainstream media is not letting these messages out. And I think it's so important that we get back to the streets like Jeannie was talking about before, protest, and that like Yvonne suggested, get in touch with your local news writers. Develop a relationship, call up, pick up the phone, and just try.
You shouldn't let
people, you know.
You should let these stories pass, because just like you commented, I didn't see the, I saw the link. But what happens is they get in touch with, and this is how it works. Even if you have a weekly newspaper, what happens is something comes up. Like, there is going to be another shooting. It's inevitable. In the next 3 months, there is going to be another
one. There was one yesterday. There was one yesterday at a Catholic university. It hasn't gotten much coverage.
Right. But there is going to be one. And what happens is someone gets assigned a story. And what happens is they need to quote somebody. They look who has been talking to them. So, like NAMI or DJ Jaffe. So what happens is they got a deadline. It's just like this, you know, Lauren, you have papers to be done. People that are online, they work on a job. You know, they said, your boss says, you've got to get this in, and we want this in by 5 o'clock. So what happens is they're not going to search to find Yvonne Smith or Maxine or Sue or someone else, because they don't have time to do that. What they do is they go to the Rolodex or who they already know, and the person, or either they go to a file, because that person has been sending them stuff all along. So, in other words, they've been sending them stuff all along. Maybe they haven't reported on it. They've never used it. You know, it might have taken 3 months, 6 months, a year. And then they said, oh, this has come up. Who can I quote? So they go to the sources they know. So we have to be the source they know. That's why Tori and Jaffe are the sources they know, because they don't have this. They have so much stuff to do. They get, and that's why we have to be omnipresent on their case, saying, look, there's another side to this. You need to hear it. You need to feed them resources and stuff, so that when I don't wish that anybody's hurt, but it's inevitable there'll be another one. I saw a story today. It's only 12 hours old of a little boy who's threatening suicide because his father won't give him pocket change. And that'll show up. So we just have to do everything we can to try to inform the press, because we don't have other people who are doing it in an organized way, and it's too many stories out here for us to do it. All of us have to be looking at our local press, our regional press.
And Lauren, I have another report from the local press.
Yes.
In Michigan, NAMI, the Senate in Michigan has passed approved involuntary commitment for substance abuse treatment, and it's going to be signed by the governor. So that's kind of ironic. They put people, they involuntarily commit people for mental health, put you on drugs, and now they're going to commit you for substance abuse. So that's
right.
That's from Michigan.
That just happened today?
This came out on the 4th on CWTV Michigan on June 4th.
Sorry, go ahead.
No, I'm done. Go ahead.
No, I was just going to say, I guess it's all part of this new Stamp Out Stigma campaign that they've got rolling out, that just started rolling out, of where they're going after mental health and substance use addictions. And so it's all getting lumped in together now, and whatever your problem, we've got a drug to solve it, and if you don't want to take it voluntarily, we have ways of forcing you. It's
methadone.
I just think that this is a real issue that we're out, and that women need to be aware of it. Again, like Sue and Don and others have talked about, 70% of women who in Canada, we know the statistic, 70% of the people who are getting electroshocked are women. In the United States, in New York, the most person most often shocked is a woman over 62 years of age. These are deeply problematic, in that they're going after children and little girls who may not be complying the way they ought to, and who's getting tagged out at young ages and drugged, and if they're in the foster care system, how this complicates it. If you'd like to call in, the number is area code 267-521-0167. area code 267-521-0167. I also know that there's some people that are just online. If you want to continue listening, please do. But if you'd like to speak at any point, just hit the one so that I know to bring you in. The activities that we have to organize and organize. I mean, that's what we have to be doing. And so to reach out to the mental health civil rights protest page on Facebook and get involved with that. The Mind Freedom International's annual conference will be in Connecticut July 24th through July 27th at Wisdom House, and you can find out more information about that at mindfreedom.org. And again, the Alliance's 34th annual Bastille Day will be in Albany in front of the New York State Office of Mental Health July 13th through the 16th. I sometimes get a little speechless as to how is this that in 2014 people are still allowed to flagrantly misrepresent what it is psychiatry can and can't do. And the idea of choice being either you can do this or we can force you, that this is not a choice.
That's why people should run. Do not walk away.
Lauren, can I share another story?
Yes, please.
Okay. I don't know if any of you were familiar with David Hilton. He was our director of Office of Consumer Affairs here in New Hampshire, and he was a very strong anti-psychiatry. He worked closely with Mind Freedom, and he started the peer support programs here in New Hampshire, and he was my mentor and a very good friend, and he was continually involuntarily committed to the state hospital for months at a time, up to 6 months. Forced medicated, and they would release him on a conditional discharge, and he would be on that for months and be forced to take medication. And he was a fearless fighter for our rights, and he eventually, 10 years ago, he committed suicide. And he was, they would just
big loss.
Continuously involuntarily commit him to the state hospital, and it was just a crime, and it was such a loss, because after his death, we have not had activism here in New Hampshire, but I just wanted to share that, because it was 10 years on September 11th was the 10-year anniversary of his suicide.
Sorry,
do you know Ken Braderman?
I do.
He's in assisted living right now. He's battling Lou Gehrig's disease.
Yes, he's dying.
And
in fact,
him and I was trying to get him to call in to give the number to us to call into Lauren's line. This is another strong advocate, and he was a newspaper person, and he is a person that I'm going to try to get him to help me, because even though he's paralyzed right now, his mind is still going. But we have a lot of people who have, I don't like to use the word fallen on the sword, but I don't know how much his psychiatric medications may have prompted him to go into Lou Gehrig's disease, but we have a lot of people that sometimes we forget about that are out there, and they just slip off under the rock. And Ken Braderman is one of them.
Yeah, I worked closely with Ken for quite a few years, so
mm-hmm. Kim and David, I met David and Ken both through rap, and we should not forget these people, because sometimes it seems as though, I'm not saying that people are don't know their history, but since had the movement for people to come inside of mental health and become providers, there's been a, except for people like Mind Freedom and Lauren, they've lost the focus on human rights, and you got to get back to that.
Well, I think there's definitely, and there's the Law Project for Psychiatric Rights and the Center for Human Rights for Users and Survivors of Psychiatry, CRUSP, and the World Network of Users and Survivors of Psychiatry. I think there are Mind Freedom Internet, Ireland. There are so many people who are doing stuff to work on human rights.
I'm not saying that they're not. I'm just saying that they're there, but they don't get a lot of support. We still should give our nickels and dimes if you have $10 or something to rub together, because it does take some money. So Mind Freedom and all these other groups, some of these other organizations that have bought into becoming part of the mental health system, they have a large amount of funding. Mind Freedom Ireland, Ghana, whatever, they don't.
No, absolutely, absolutely. And I think that's a big issue. I mean, I was just looking at a post earlier today, I don't know where it went now, about the amount of money that is being funneled in for lobbying from the pharmaceutical industry. And so the total, for according to opensecrets.org, looking at their Center for Responsive Politics, looking at their page on pharmaceuticals, health products, for example, in 2013, the total for pharmaceutical health products for lobbying went to $226,114,456. And so if people want to know why the government is continually supporting the use of these psychiatric drugs and on other pharmaceuticals, it is in part, I can guarantee you, because of this $226 million that is getting pumped into campaigns. And
they have lobbyists down K Street. I'm in Washington. They call it K Street lobbyists. They have offices there, and they are omnipresent on the Hill. And when they come, these are the people who they get six-figure incomes. They come with expense accounts to take the congressman or senator out. They give money to the campaign. They will send them on. Sometimes people don't understand that the way that sometimes things are done, people don't get a quid pro. It's not like, you do this for me and I give you dollars. It might be, you do this and you can go on a golf junket or something else here. So there's lots of, thanks to your program, Lauren, I have people coming and giving me information about how things are done. Some of them I already know, but some of the nuances, it's like, you know, kind of an under the table type of thing until they get caught, you know. We'll take you and 10 of your friends to the Super Bowl.
Right, and so the same way the pharma reps are buying off, they used to buy off the doctors. They're by law not allowed to do that anymore. So now they buy off the administrative assistants to get them to make appointments to see the doctors, and it's just a buying off, and they're buying and trading us like we are slaves. And we need to stand up and say that this cannot be done anymore. How many more women are going to be labeled with borderline personality disorder and electroshocked and drugged because of their husband or father or brother's say-so? How many more times is this going to happen, that issues of domestic violence and trauma and abuse and just oppression in general that people have to exist under in the society, when are we going to start focusing on these issues as a society and stop letting the media control the conversation and the heavily funded pharmaceutical industry's contributions to these campaigns that are all just pushing out the same message?
It's the media, because, like I said, I had this conversation with Maxine today, And it was like sort of I knew this stuff, but I didn't kind of belong to me. And it was like, you know, the pharmaceutical companies, I mean, she was saying to me, she says, don't you realize they have ads on TV? I said, yeah, I know they have ads on TV. But, you know, I kind of think the news media should kind of be insulated. Well, you know, they provide the dollars for advertisement. You know, who pays can have some say-so. So, you know, I would love to have campaign finance wherein we would have public financing of congressional races. I think it's a moral sin that every 2 years somebody running for office has to raise all of this money to run. As soon as they get in office, they have to do all of this. But this is the system that we have. We don't have a system wherein we had a system where there was public campaign dollars and you got X, everybody got X, you got X number of dollars or you got so much time on radio and TV and that was it. But we make it so that people have to raise millions of dollars for a two-year campaign. For the Senate, they call it the Billionaires Club. I mean, you really have to have lots of money. You can't be president of the United States unless you have billions of dollars. And pharmaceuticals and healthcare companies, you know, they say if you want money, you go to banks.
And it's a machine, and I think that we all need to be, you know, that we're aware of this. That this is a machine, and they are just promulgating this information at their own benefit. And we are for anybody who doesn't realize this yet, with the DSM-5 that Maxine, and I thank you for all the information you send me if you're listening, two of the National Institute of Mental Health directors have debunked the DSM. They have said that this is a fraud, that this is not reliable, this does not have the science behind it, and yet anybody can be caught up by it. The ability to psychiatrically diagnose somebody because there is no blood test or brain scan or any kind of actual physical.
We should try to make that go
existing.
Viral. I'm going to try to make that. I'm going to post that on all the social media that I have. We should try to get the when things like that happen and people that are widely respected come out and they acknowledge the truth. We should try to make these things go viral. You know, because the little people, and I call myself one of the little people too, we are collectively, as, you know, Maya Angelou used to say, we have one finger to poke, but if we put all of our fingers together, we can make a powerful force. And that's what we got to do. We got to pay attention every day to these news articles and these stories, and we have to call the press on it. When we do find people that are brave enough to come out and say that psychiatry is bogus, we have to make that. It's not going to be front page news on the Washington Post or New York Times. We have to use whatever we can to get the word out. So because, like I said, you can see the Washington Post, the Wall Street Journal, they have tie-ins to all of these people who are making money off of the misery of others.
And it's torture, and it's a crime against humanity, and they shouldn't be able to do it. And what they're doing to women and children is just abhorrent, and it's unconscionable. And that they're doing it at a profit is just another symptom of the sick society living in.
Biggest thing I see myself, I foreshadow, the biggest thing that I think is going to come down the pike is databases. And I think that people should be carefully listening. You're carefully listening when they talk about collecting information, categorizing people, because, you know, you can say, well, it's for a good purpose. But, you know, later on, the database can be used. There was I had posted a story about in Ontario, Canada. And you have to look at what happens in other countries, too. That the police released a list of people who had tried attempted suicide.
Right, and they're preventing them from being able to cross the border, right? The RCPM is that they're keeping these databases, that this is private health information that people should not be getting access to, and that it's often private health information that is based on a fraud is even more problematic. And so, yeah, citizenship and even being able to just visit the United States from Canada is now barred for you if you have a psychiatric history. And these make it terribly complicated. If you'd like to call in, the number is area code 267-521-0167, area code 267-521-0167. And there are a couple of people online who, anybody have anything that they'd like to add at this point?
Yes, I would. This is I would like to add something again, Ms. Anderson. Has anybody been seeing the Raw and Uncut 2014 and Telehub News exclusive by Jordan Maxwell?
No.
He taught. It's a very, very, very good show to watch. If you get to the YouTube, it's under Jordan Maxwell, J-O-R-D-E-N Maxwell, M-A-X-W-E-L-L. And he talks about how our system from the beginning of time, from even Caesar's time, and what our Pope actually comes from, Caesar, Comte de Dupont, is, and how our system, we actually own nothing. Our system was built this way for a reason and a purpose, and it's all a political mask of making money and who owns this and who owns that. And he puts it so eloquently how we actually, in our lives, our dollar is just another exchange for a piece of paper. And same with our homes and our cars and the tags that we put on our cars, and they keep tabs on us like we're lab rats. And they do it through religion and socially, economically, through politically, through culturally, in every aspect. We have been touched by our system, and it really expresses so much and gives such an understanding of how our society, what our society truly has been built upon. And it all has to do with this political regime, no matter how you look at it, the pharmaceutical, the mental health, the DCF, the psychiatric units, the veterans, everything. And I really, really do think that people should watch this. It's just amazing, and it really put things into a greater prospect in my mind to what's truly happening and what we can do. And it's not like standing up and fighting like wars. It's by all of us getting together, communicating, talking to other people, getting together, letting each other know what's going on out there. Like you said, posting, mindfreedom.com, all these wonderful links are so great to have.
They really are.
People.
Yeah, mindfreedom.org. And I think that, yeah, there are so many things, ways that people can get connected if you're not currently connected, and that there is a complete political machine that is driving this, and that this is a multi-billion dollar industry annually. Trillions and trillions of dollars over time is invested into this fraud. And I'm just looking at the National Institute of Health website on women and mental health, and so they say women mental illnesses affect women and men differently. some disorders are more common in women and some express themselves with different symptoms. Scientists now are only beginning to tease apart the contributions of various biological and psychosocial factors to mental health and mental illness in both women and men. In addition, researchers are currently studying the special problems of treatment for serious mental illness during pregnancy and the postpartum period. So, again, no biological evidence. They are just trying to tease apart, quote-unquote, contributions of various biological and psychosocial factors. And then they actually say that there is some, quote-unquote, mental illnesses that are affect women, and these include anxiety disorders, including OCD, panic, PTSD, social phobia, and generalized anxiety disorder, attention deficit hyperactivity disorder, bipolar disorder, borderline personality disorder, depression, postpartum depression, eating disorders, and schizophrenia. And so the fact that they are putting forth
women.
Just women who are that these are the prevalent disorders of women, that these are also the things that are socially mediated by culture and values and economics and with the idea of postpartum hormones, it's such an absolute fraud. It's such an absolute fraud. This is how Jackie Kennedy, as the wife of the then senator, was able to get locked up and electroshocked. This is, the symptoms of borderline personality disorder, according to the National Institute of Health, quote, most people who have BPD suffer from problems with regulating emotions and thoughts, impulsive and reckless behavior, and unstable relationships with other people. And so the misogynistic attitude toward women that they should be silent and sit and look pretty and whatever other antiquated ideas that some people have about what a woman can and cannot do are all categorized through this idea of, you know, a woman speaking out and making her voice heard. And I think that the social realities that women are challenged with, particularly when they are involved with psychiatry, are very important to shine a light on.
Well, we don't have it's unfortunate. They used to call it hysteria.
Right.
But, you know, if we look at other countries like Sudan and the way they treat women, we are very harsh about it. But when we look at our own country and we look at how we do that, and like I said, sometimes things are very subtle. That there are ways in which you can. That's why people have to pay attention to all the attacks on our liberty, male and female. I mean, most of these. I don't know any of these mass killings that when they always support that. We've got to take this action or do this to prevent violence. I don't know any of them that have been done by women. All of them are done by men. But a lot of the actions.
Oh, all of these mass shootings? Well, all of these mass shootings, yeah, they're all white men, yeah.
White males are privileged. I mean, maybe Jonesboro or something. They're not poor. They're middle income and higher of privilege. But yet, people that look like me are going to be the ones that are going to be targeted. Young black males are the first ones, young black male youth are the first ones that will be pressed into a child and youth services or I hate using the word juvenile delinquency because you don't have you don't have things to engage people in their community. I mean, some of the opponents, they poo-poo things like maybe a basketball program or something that combats loneliness. They'd rather spend, on that person, they'd rather spend thousands of dollars a month on some kind of drug versus maybe a couple of hundred dollars per person so that they would have a night basketball or something like that. or have something to combat bullyingism in the schools. You know, it's just very sad the way that the pharmaceutical country has hijacked our youth, they continue to. And these solutions, people have to see them as not as solutions, but as another end game around to bring pharmaceuticals into our life. It's like they've never seen a customer that they didn't like. I mean, I give you an example. We, you know, when you went to the store and you wanted to buy rice, you remember when you got a bag of rice and brought it home and cooked it? Well, now you don't do that. You go into the frozen section, they have rice that's already cooked, or you go into the dry goods section, they have one that gives you 90 minutes. It's the same thing for the pharmaceuticals. You know, people used to get plain, and I don't want to give any airtime. There isn't meds, but you got one of the meds that gave you breasts, Unite for men. You might get that, you know, in pill form. Well, now they have it where you've been taking this for 2 weeks. So, you know, a lot of these things, they just recycle. And it's almost like the old movie that Charlton Heston was in and at the end where he's dying and he says, "Stolen green is the people." So after a while, we won't be eating food. We'll just be taking pills.
Well, I think that we're definitely in a challenge. But when it comes to discrimination in psychiatry, there is a wealth of evidence of how this is getting carried out. And if these shootings were something that happened in a neighborhood that was economically challenged and that was struggling and that was already under other oppressions and discriminations, we would not be having the same conversation, because people are getting killed every day and nobody's paying attention to it. It's when one of these issues where it affects people who are experiencing any kind of privilege, and those privileges vary. When there's one of these tragic situations in that neighborhood, then all of a sudden everybody's ready to cast out laws that is going to limit all of the civil liberties of all of us. And people need to realize that there were a couple of murders here, but there were 10,000 murders last year. So what murders are we talking about? Because the overwhelming majority of murders, nobody ever hears a word of. This is a politically designed campaign in order to push forward laws that people have been trying to get pushed forward. And like Yvonne said, unfortunately, this is going to happen again, because that is just the reality of the world that we live in. And people should be preparing, in addition to trying to create alternatives and create community and be supportive of others and all of that kind of stuff. We should be preparing information to get to them. Now is the time to start calling your reporters before there is an incident. Because when there is an incident, like Yvonne said, they're just running through the numbers trying to find out whoever they can find. They don't have time to be talking to you because they're trying to get a story out. And so it's in the in-between times that we really need to be reaching out to reporters and developing those relationships and getting our voice heard in the mainstream media by people who will be daring to do it. And that may start by doing alternative media journals and by posting comments. But, you know, posting comments doesn't always work, especially on the federal government's website. And I just want to give an update about the comment that I had left for Paolo Delvecchio about his comment about there, you know, because there's no vaccine, that, you know, we shouldn't stop trying to prevent this thing from happening. And SAMHSA has put other comments up, and my comment is still in, quote-unquote, being moderated. And so I'm not sure that the world will ever get to see that, have access to it, or other peoples who have also put up comments, and their comments are also being moderated. But I know that they went through them, because there's comments from the day before and the day after, and so somehow.
This program is so valuable, and we should be paying more attention to. If they pay as much attention to women who were hurt and killed by domestic violence, there are more women. I'm going to try to look at the data for the next show. I think that there's more women hurt by domestic violence. That's a more of a predictor of whether a person is going to do something. If you've got a history of domestic violence, that's more of a predictor of whether you're going to kill someone, hurt someone, versus somebody that says that you may or may not have a emotional distress. And
right.
We don't
I've got to clarify this. We also know that previous acts of violence do not necessarily predict future acts of violence. And we need to
Jared Lofter hadn't done anything. This guy in California, he bought 3 guns. Chow in Virginia, I mean, he did go before a judge or whatever, but, you know, they bought into the stereotype of the good Asian. But most of these people, they are law-abiding citizens. And you're not going, with any draconian measures, you're not going to capture them. And that's the point. You're going to have databases, and that's what I'm worried about, is that children will be marked and scarred for the rest of their life because they made some comment, and they're going to be seen, categorized as a diagnosis. And,
absolutely, and the electronic medical records kick in with probably in under a year now, if not months. Within the year, the electronic medical database for the United States will be up and running, and so every doctor that you go to will know your psychiatric and any substance use history that you have, and will be also mandated under the Affordable Care Act for your general practitioner to do mental health and substance use screenings on you. This is not for people who have psychiatric histories. This is for anyone and everyone receiving medical services. That there will be a mandated mental health screening for everybody. And for people to understand that these screenings, that does not mean that you're taking a blood test. That means that you're going to be asked a series of 10 questions, and debated on how you answer those questions will be the result as to whether or not you get referred to having to go see a psychiatrist. And it's going to get very interesting to see what happens once all of these health insurance companies are going to have to be paying for this mandated psychiatric treatment because they want to psychiatrize us all. That is their explicit goal.
New York to Connecticut to the Mind Freedom thing, and I'm not completely on the tip line, but I'm going to ask you now in a future show, I don't know if you know, could you have someone else from Mind Freedom to tell us a little bit about what's going to be happening at the Mind Freedom Conference?
Yes, Celia was actually on the other night discussing it, and we can definitely have that again, but I can let you know that it's going to be a really phenomenal event at Wisdom House in Connecticut. And if you're looking for information for that, you can go to www.mindfreedom.org, and there is still registration open, and there's also day pass registrations that are open. The conference is a great place to connect with like-minded people, get involved with advocacy and activism, and learn a phenomenal amount of information. The program is still being organized, but there are going to be some phenomenal workshops in addition to the keynote speakers, who include Robert Whitaker. And if you haven't read Robert Whitaker's books, Anatomy of an Epidemic and Mad in America, I suggest that you do. That are absolutely brilliant. Mary Ellen Copeland of the RAP Plans, Wellness Recovery Action Planning, will also be there. And as we talked about on the show on Memorial Day, that she has special RAP plans also that are could be used by veterans who are coming back or still at war, obviously, soldiers fighting. There'll also be from Soteria House, Susan Musanti, the executive director of Soteria Alaska, will be there. Foster Berg and the house manager, and Amos Meacham, the project director of Soteria Vermont. Then there'll also be a lot of information about peer-run respite programs, and they'll have people there from the Western Mass Recovery Learning Community. Chris Hansen will be there from Intentional Peer Support. the Asylum Peer Respite in Vermont. Gloria Vandenberg will be there, as well as Rosalind Hayes. It's just going to be an amazing lineup of people. The Sunrise Center with withdrawing from psychiatric.
This is a. It sounds like this will be much better for me to come to something like this, where I can get.
Yeah, it's going to be really, really amazing. And there's also going to be the Sunrise Center that works on withdrawing from psychiatric drugs. Janet Foner is going to be there with Joan McKenzie and Hannah Gross and Bob Ketchman. There's going to be information about open dialogue programs and also the Hearing Voices Network. Some of those people are going to be there, including Lisa Forestell from and Marty Hedge again. And, you know, you can register online. It's really, really reasonable. We're all going to be sharing rooms together. This is a great retreat center. So you can have, for the entire conference, a shared room, shared bath, $380 for the entire registration and all meals and lodging included. And then they also have commuter rates and day rates for people also with lunch and dinner. And so you can find out more information at mindfreedom.org, www.mindfreedom.org. Yeah, you wanted to ask something?
I think that I was asking about that because I wanted people to know on the show, and also if you plan to have, or there might be people listening in who are veterans, but that's a hot topic that I liked when you had the panel of people on there. There may be people that may want to come forth that are veterans, that they should be encouraged to call your tip line so that you could have lots of people to exchange information, because I just find this so helpful to me. As I was saying to Maxine today, that sometimes, you know, it's very lonely when you're out here trying to put forth a good effort, that there are people that don't mean us very well, and you seem like you're by yourself, and there are people all over the country in the 48 states and in Canada. And I'm quite sure that there are veterans out here who are not happy with the veteran system that has caused them to be over-medicated, to actually kill them, because we know from the press, who we know is an F, has reported that they've been waiting for care and can't get it, and that also that they've been getting painkillers and psychiatric drugs to such degree that they go home and take the medication. I shouldn't say medication. They take the chemicals as prescribed, and they die because it's too much for them. And I just know that with us being involved in these wars for like 10 years, that there's got to be people like Walter Hudson and others who are out there that need to get word out about what's happening with our veterans. And I would hope that you would be open having them on as well.
Oh, absolutely. And if anybody, veterans included, and I think that, you know, and thank you for your service if you're listening, I think that it's really important that people speak out. And so if you are an organizer or an advocate or doing something in terms of trying to protect and promote the human rights of people who are involved with psychiatry and would like to be on a guest on the show, you can call me at area code 718-273-8708 to schedule something, and let's talk about figuring out how to get you on the air. And also, if you have a tip that you'd like to leave about a human rights violation that you would like to have addressed publicly, or a death that you know of that you think needs to be investigated, you can also call the tip line at area code 718-273-8708. In the coming weeks, we're going to have some really phenomenal shows. On June 11th, we will be having a follow-up special on electroshock. focusing entirely on informed consent and litigation strategies that people can take with Deborah from ectjustice.com. And so that will run 9 to 11 on Wednesday, June 11th. And then in the coming time, people that have been on that are going to be coming back on to spend a good chunk of time talking about their work include Dr. John Breeding, Dr. Brenda LeFrancois. Sevia is going to be coming on at one time talking about some of the books that she's done and alternative thinking about depression. Dr. Bonnie Burstow from Canada will be on in the near future, as will others. And we will continue to have these open line calls of where people can share their experiences and further connect people into their networks and the work that they're doing. I think it's so important for everybody to remember that there is support out there if you're looking for it, and if you're being involuntarily involved with psychiatry, go to mindfreedom.org and you can create a Mind Freedom Shield alert, which would activate the Mind Freedom membership, which is over 10,000 people, to speak out on your behalf with a message that you want told to the people who are involuntarily treating you. It's another great way of ensuring that you have somebody looking out for you if you're involved with this type of involuntary psychiatry. Again, I want to just go back to some of the books that I mentioned earlier. Geller and Harris's Women of the Asylum, Phyllis Chesler's Women and Madness, and Kate Millett's The Loony Bin Trip. And all really have a phenomenal amount of information on their websites, and if you Google any of them, you can find that information. To our guests, Jeannie and Ms. Anderson, do you have anything else you'd like to say prior to, we've got just a couple of minutes left.
I want to say that actually I want to end with a message of hope, because I believe that if we look at what the civil rights movement was able to accomplish, and if we put into practice the things that the civil rights movement did, then we can accomplish whatever we want. We can do whatever we want. It's just a matter of control, raising our voices, and making sure that we're heard. And if enough people come together and raise their voices, then things will change, and we do have a lot of power as individuals, but we have incredible power as a community. And I don't want people to ever think that things can't change, because they can and they will. So I just wanted to end with a message of hope, because I guess I'm an idealist, which is good and bad, but I believe that that we can and will change the status quo.
Jeannie, I thank you for speaking out, and for anybody who doesn't know, in the 1970s, when this started up again, this was a civil rights movement. It was a liberation movement like all of the other liberation movements, and we need to get back to our roots and start speaking out. And so go to the Mental Health Civil Rights Protest page on Facebook and get involved there and all of these other places. Ms. Anderson, do you have anything you'd like to add?
No, I want to thank you very much for sharing your time and for all the great insights and all the other people that came on and shared they had to say. I learned a lot, and I truly believe in hope, and I also believe in the civil rights movement. We all have to stand together and stay together and press on forward and do what we need to do to change our laws in our own state.
Well, I thank you. I thank you for calling in and for sharing your story and the hope that you have for us moving forward. And I also believe that we can and that we must. that we must every day make an action to inform the general public, to reach out to the media. Yvonne, I thank you sincerely for calling in. Sue and others who came in tonight, thank you for sharing your time with us. And I'm going to ask you to keep on talking until I talk to you next time. Talk to you soon. Thanks, everybody.
Thanks, Yvonne.